From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Michael Krasny. Next month marks the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act being signed into law. The ADA prohibits discrimination against people with disabilities. It's a landmark law which supporters say has had a profound impact on lowering barriers for access to everything from work to transportation and parks. But critics say the ADA is often used by unscrupulous attorneys to shake down small businesses with threatening lawsuits. The ADA at 25, its accomplishments and problems. We'll get started with Forum right after this. And welcome to KQED's Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. Well, it was 25 years ago next month that President George H.W. Bush signed the Americans with Disabilities Act. It was widely hailed at the time as a landmark civil rights legislation prohibiting discrimination based on disability. And in the quarter century since the law took effect, it's helped lower barriers for people with disabilities at work, in public accommodations, transit, and more. But it also has plenty of critics who say the ADA is exploited to unfairly target small businesses especially. And that is our topic this hour of Forum, the ADA at 25. Let me tell you who's here with us. Joining me here in the studio, Carla Johnson is director of San Francisco's Office of Disability in the mayor's office. Good morning.
Good morning, Scott.
And joining us by phone is Kim Stone. She's president of Civil Justice Association of California. That's a coalition of advocates and business leaders looking to reform the civil justice system. Welcome to you, Kim Stone, as well.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Let me begin with you, Carla Johnson. I know you've been in your position since before the ADA was signed, and I'm wondering if you could just take us back to that time, 1989, pre-1990. What was life like for folks with disabilities in this country?
Life was actually very different for people with disabilities. You couldn't easily navigate our public right-of-way. We didn't have very many curb ramps, so you couldn't be independently traveling on your own on our streets and sidewalks. Our transportation systems didn't have things like elevators and lifts and ramps in order to be able to get on the buses. And, of course, the buses are such a lifeline in order to give us the opportunity to go to school, to go to work, to visit family members, and do our daily business.
And the ADA changed that not only because the law changed, but what did it say about attitudes at the time and changing attitudes?
Well, you know, perceptions about disability are, of course, one of those lingering issues. What it said about people with disabilities is that people with disabilities have all of the same rights to fully participate in our civil society, to have an opportunity for economic self-sufficiency, and, you know, to be able to work in the workplace and go to school and be out on the streets.
You mentioned sort of the physical infrastructure, curb cuts and elevators, escalators, whatever it might be, that improve access. What are some of the other kinds of things that didn't require building something or changing the physical shape of something that have made the biggest difference?
We call that the programmatic access side of the Americans with Disabilities Act, and one key element of that is effective communication, making sure that somebody who is deaf, for example, has the opportunity to communicate in American Sign Language as they come to access a city service or government benefit. It's also about making sure that people who are blind are able to read the material in the same way that people who have sight. And so where that plays out oftentimes is in materials, how we issue materials to people, how we have conversations with people, but also how we develop our websites, because these days with technology, websites are often that first portal of a communication so people can access services.
And how does it apply to the internet, the ADA?
Well, actually, under Section 508 of the Rehabilitation Act, there are obligations to be equally effective in how we, distribute our information. And so when you look at website access as an example, you want to make sure that that website is developed so that a person who is blind can actually read all of the text and the images using screen reader software.
And that applies to anybody with a website?
Well, technically, 508 applies to the federal government and any of the agencies that are funded by the federal government. But as you look at the ADA as an ever-evolving animal, what you see is that there are more and more cases that are brought about how the public accommodation side also communicates with their clients.
And what are the data show? You know, in terms of how the ADA has affected people, it makes sense, of course, that that barriers have fallen and people with disabilities feel more included and are more included and have better access. But how do you measure that?
Well, I think you measure it really by working with the disability community and seeing what type of issues they bring to your attention. And I think that all of us recognize and acknowledge that we've made great progress in the 25 years since the Americans with Disabilities Act, but there's still barriers that remain. There are issues out there about income inequality. There's a lack of affordable and accessible housing, which makes it difficult for people to live independently if they don't have the right kinds of supports that they need in the community. And employment, of course, too, because employment really, patches nicely into all of those issues because that's part of how we become independent.
What role did San Francisco and the Bay Area play in pushing for this law? Because, it passed, as you know, in 1990 with very little opposition. It passed 91-6 in the U.S. Senate. I think it passed in the House without any opposition. It was unanimous, which is very hard to imagine today. How did that support get built, and what role did the Bay Area play?
And there's a lot of nuance in that support, too, and I think it evolved over time. I wouldn't assume that the support was all there at the beginning. But San Francisco and the Bay Area have historically been leaders in the disability rights and the independent living movement. It can really be traced back to Ed Roberts in 1962 when he joined University of California, Berkeley, and was able to advocate for being able to attend school independently and be housed. The first independent living centers in California were brought about in 1972. That was our first Governor Brown. That was one of his actions, working again with Ed Roberts. But there was a very seminal event here in San Francisco in 1977, and that was a federal occupation, or I should say an occupation of the San Francisco Federal Building over the federal government's failure to sign the Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. And this occupation—
Which was what?
It was an act that was voted on in 1973, but it hadn't actually taken effect. It lacked that last important signature until 1977. It was an act that basically prohibited the discrimination against people with disabilities. And with the federal government, they oftentimes start with these broad goals, and then they expect the technology and cities and such to follow. But this 504 occupation of the federal building was really unprecedented. It lasted for 26 days, which is the single longest occupation of a federal building. There were over 100 disability advocates from San Francisco and the greater Bay Area who participated. And if you can imagine, in 1977, a building that had not been retrofitted for access, occupied by people who needed the basic access features like ramps and restrooms and showers and such, you can understand really what an incredible dedication and hardship that was.
That's Carla Johnson. She's director of the San Francisco Mayor's Office on Disability, and we're talking about the Americans with Disabilities Act. It turns 25 next month, and Carla, tomorrow at San Francisco City Hall, there's going to be an event sort of honoring that, commemorating that anniversary?
There is. Our event tomorrow in City Hall is from 11:30 into 1:30 in the North Light Court. And what it is a kickoff to ADA month. In past years, we've celebrated ADA Day. But this year, given the enormity of the event of the 25th anniversary, we really wanted to put a lot more effort into this.
Let's bring Kim Stone in. Kim is president of the Civil Justice Association of California. And Kim, from your perspective and that of your members, how do you see the ADA?
Well, I agree with a lot of what Carla said. There have been tremendous improvements in employment and in public services and in telecommunications and even in public accommodations and commercial facilities, many of which have been for the good. But there is a difference between how the ADA was passed in 1990 by Congress, which only allowed lawsuits for injunctive relief, which means to fix the problem, and then attorney's fees in order to bring small businesses that were not compliant up to compliance. But then what California did as a state was we said every violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act is also a violation of our UNRU Act, which allowed thousands of dollars in penalties plus attorney's fees and has sadly led to waves of extortionate lawsuits over the Americans with Disabilities Act and little increase in compliance. And so that one aspect of the ADA, the commercial facilities enforcement aspect of it, I think sadly has been a public policy failure.
So when you say there's been very little compliance increase, why don't businesses comply? Wouldn't they avoid the lawsuits then?
Well, they would, exactly. If businesses were compliant, they wouldn't be sued. And any small businesses that are listening, I would strongly recommend that they go out and hire a state certified access specialist, get their business checked out, find out if they're compliant or not, and if they're not, make the accommodations in order to become compliant. But sadly, even 25 years later, many small businesses don't know that this burden rests entirely on them. If you're opening up a small business, you are checked out by the building code. If you're a restaurant, you are checked out by ABC to make sure you're legitimate. You have a number of governmental officials who come out, and you have to go through all sorts of permitting processes, and nobody in the government, it's nobody's job to say, hey, you're ADA compliant or not, and if you're not, these are the things you need to do to fix it. That burden rests entirely on the business to go hire the right kind of expert to find out if they're compliant or not. And many businesses don't know that, or they think that it's the landlord's responsibility, or they think because they have a disabled customer who comes in every Tuesday and is able to access the facilities that they're fine. And sadly, that's not the case. And so what happens in a lot of these predatory ADA access lawsuits is that a very small number of unscrupulous plaintiff's attorneys go around and sue dozens or hundreds of businesses many times at the same time, and then settle for money only, you know, just want $10,000 or $5,000, don't even require as a condition of the lawsuit that the business actually become compliant. And that's a very different result.
But let me just stop you for a sec, because
what Congress intended.
Yeah. So that business could then be sued again? You're saying?
Absolutely.
They pay the money, but then they're not compliant. They still don't comply. They could get sued.
Absolutely. And well, so we hear a lot. I go around and do talks about to small businesses about how they can become compliant with the ADA, which, again, is mostly hiring the certified access specialist who knows what to do, getting your business checked out, and then figuring out a way to become compliant, because that is the only way to protect yourself from one of these lawsuits. But a lot of people just don't know that. And then, sadly, a number of these lawyers really are just in it for their money. It's not like, you know, some of the examples that were given in when the ADA was passed was that, oh, you know, it's a shame. Like, people want to go to the movies and they can't go in. People want to go out to lunch with their families and they can't get into the restaurant. And that's absolutely a wrong that deserves to be righted. And so what the ADA, what the federal law did was say, if you're in a situation like that, absolutely, you can sue that business, but you're not going to get rich off of it. You're going to say, hey, I want to go out to lunch with my family, or I want to go to the movies, and if you're not going to become compliant, I'm going to sue you. You become compliant. The lawyer in that case would be compensated for their time, but nobody's going to make a bunch of extra money on it.
Have other states done that as well, sort of added it to their...
Yeah, so only a few. California, New York, Florida, I think maybe Illinois. I just got a call from someone in Minnesota. We were one of the first, not surprisingly, as we are with many sort of pro-litigation innovations. But what the bad thing about what we did is you have a bunch of these crappy lawsuits that are just about money, and yet the small businesses are still not compliant. Like, one of the reasons, so it was very unusual, you were right, that you noted that there was very little opposition and that this, I mean, there was a big fight leading up to it and that this was viewed as a compromise measure. And one of the reasons it was because there was no, they didn't want to have a governmental body enforcing it. They didn't want to have, like, the Department of Disability that would be more government bureaucracy that would lead to additional expense. And so the idea was, okay, we'll leave enforcement to the private sector, the private attorneys, when there's actually a problem. But then when we in California added the ability to get thousands of dollars mm-hmm. per lawsuit plus attorney's fees, that's why we've ended up in this situation where hundreds of small businesses, you know, get sued in these lawsuits.
That's Kim Stone from the Civil Justice Association of California. We're talking about the Americans with Disabilities Act. It turns 25 next month, and we'd love to hear from you. Let's open the phone lines early. If you yourself have a disability that the ADA has helped you overcome, or if you have a family member, or if you're a small business person who's come up against some of the things Kim Stone was just describing, we'd love to hear from you. 866-733-6786 is the number to call, 866-733-6786. And you can always email us as well. It's forum@kqed.org, or leave us a message on our Facebook page, or tweet us. We're at KQED Forum. Carl, what about that point about the inspections? I mean, San Francisco is... People have all kinds of complaints about building inspections and permits in San Francisco. Why not require that any sort of an inspection include an ADA inspection as part of that to getting the stamp of approval?
Well, I'm really glad that Kim brought up the Certified Accessibility Specialist Program, because that is really another place where California has led the nation. This is a program that passed in our legislature about 6 or 8 years ago, and it established this group of credentialed inspectors, CASP inspectors, who have the ability to go out to these public accommodations and to make an inspection and identify the barriers and give those small businesses and big businesses the tools that they need in order to be able to remove the barriers to not only make their businesses accessible to our clients with disabilities, but also to protect themselves from these lawsuits in the future.
So could you get a permit? Let's say you're opening a new business, a restaurant in San Francisco. Can you get a permit to open if you're not ADA compliant?
Well, this is the tension between building codes and civil rights codes, because under the California Building Code, the level of access that you provide for that business is really driven by the amount of construction activity that is part of that permit. And that may not be really the whole picture of the barriers that exist out there at that business. This is one of the reasons why the ADA is so important, because whether you are remodeling or improving your property or not, as a business, you still have the obligation to remove the barriers that are readily achievable. And readily achievable by definition means shouldn't be too hard, shouldn't be too expensive. But when you look at that threshold of readily achievable and you think about, you know, 1 year into the ADA, it's a very different threshold from 25 years after the ADA. And it would be our hope that businesses would be planning for the projects over time. But going back to the CAS program, when the CAS program was passed in our legislature, it was really an effort to raise the bar for the building departments and also for the architects to make sure that those individuals had the correct level of training so that they would understand the codes and they would do a better job of problem solving so that they could provide the support to the businesses and make the businesses accessible.
All right, we've got some
but
folks.
Kim
Stone.
How difficult it is?
Sure, go ahead.
Here in Sacramento, we recently redid Terminal B in our airport. It was, you know, a multi-million dollar remodel. And shortly after it was open, the airport was hit with a lawsuit by disability rights folks citing numerous ways in which it was not accessible. And so that just shows you that it's not just small businesses, but the Americans with Disabilities Act sort of regulations enforcing it is a book about an inch and a half thick with these pictures in it. And then California Building Code has the same thing, and there are these very detailed schematic drawings. They make IKEA directions look like they were written by Hemingway. I mean, they are very complicated, very specific, and even, you know, complicated, expensive, high-level projects like the Sacramento Airport mess up. And so the tricky thing for small businesses is, like even if you're a new business, you think that because you've been inspected seven ways from Sunday from everybody and their aunt in the government that you must be okay, and somebody would have told you if you weren't, and that's absolutely not the case. The onus rests entirely on the business to become compliant. People also may think falsely that they're somehow grandfathered in. Like if they have an old business that's been around and hasn't been changed in a number of years. Well, this is, I'm in an old or quote-unquote historic building. Well, just because it's old doesn't mean that it's historic, and there is no exception or no grandfathering for that. And so there's just, a, you know, there's areas of San Francisco, Chinatown, for example, where almost every one of the businesses in there you have to step up to get into. That's an ADA violation right there.
Yeah, Carla?
Many of them have doors that need to be opened using twisting, pinching, or grabbing. That's another ADA violation right there.
Yeah.
You know, I just want to clarify that cities and counties face the same challenge as well. And part of what we do at the Mayor's Office on Disability is we look at our own city facilities and we put together the plans to remove barriers at that location too. And I have a really good example of that. Our office has undertaken a barrier removal project at a qualified historic structure. It's the Bayview Opera House in the southeastern part of our city, and it was built in 1888. And one of the basic premises under the ADA, which is consistent with our civil rights legislation, is that separate but equal is never equal. And the Bayview Opera House used to have one of those backdoor entrances where the rest of the community had the pleasure of coming in the front door, but people with disabilities only had the opportunity to go into the back door. And under this capital improvement project, our office, working in collaboration with the Arts Commission and the MTA and the district supervisor, have been able to take this historic structure and really bring it back so that it's something that the entire community can enjoy.
And that's with funds from where?
It's funds from the San Francisco Capital Plan. Our city...
It's a general fund.
It's a general fund, exactly. We're very methodical and strategic in how we identify which barriers we are going to remove and what in what order. And we started by removing the barriers to government services. Those were the priorities coming from the community. We moved to health and human services. And now we're in our cultural facilities, which
All
really
right.
is where the community comes together.
All right. I did open up the phone lines. Let's see if we can get a quick call in here. Bob from Napa, you're on. If you could just have a really quick question.
Yes, sir. So the situation, I work for a municipality, and we just built a multi-million dollar building, and there's areas that are accessed by the public, which obviously should be covered by ADA, but there's a large portion of the building that are not accessed by the public. They probably never would be accessed. And those are also being involved in a huge ADA issue where we're having to remodel a multi-million dollar building, and no one's even occupied it yet because this huge quagmire of ADA codes that we're having to go through on a building that will never be accessed by the public other than a small portion of the front of the office.
Yeah. Quick comment, Carla, and then we're going to go to a break. If a building is not even meant to, is not going to get access from the public, they still have to meet the ADA codes?
Well, it's an interesting distinction, you know, and this is a place where California law is actually more restrictive than our federal law, because under the California Building Code, the access regulations apply to the employee side of the building as well. And so there's a broader spectrum of coverage so that people with disabilities can work in that city building.
All right. We're going to have much more to say about the ADA in the next half hour, and I invite you to join us. 866-733-6786 is the number to call, and the lines are pretty full. Also, if you want to email us, it's forum@kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. Stay with us. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here this morning for Michael Krasny. And our topic this hour is the Americans with Disabilities Act. It was signed into law 25 years ago next month by President George H.W. Bush. And my guests this hour, Carla Johnson, Director of the San Francisco Mayor's Office on Disability, and Kim Stone, President of the Civil Justice Association of California. If you want to join us, the number to call, 866-733-6786. And let's go to the phones. Milton in Oakland. Welcome.
Good morning. There are a number of restaurants in my neighborhood that have very heavy front doors. Now, I know, because I've seen them, that they can be, electrical work can be done on them, and a large button can be placed beside them. So a person in a wheelchair simply pushes the button, the door opens. Now, I don't know if there's a very expensive, you know, thing that can say, I can't afford this accessibility. Probably I don't think the restaurant owners can, you know, use that excuse. And if a complaint is filed, how quickly and how efficiently do the people who are regulating these things respond to complaints?
Carla?
Well, what the caller is describing actually is a power door operator, and under the codes, the maximum amount of pressure that can be in place for you before you open the door is 5 pounds. And many doors, as you've noted, don't meet that standard. And so power door operators really allow somebody to operate that door independently. You press the button with the footrest of your wheelchair or with the tip of your finger, and the door just opens. The average cost to install a power door operator is anywhere between $3,500 and $5,000. And so whether or not that's affordable really depends upon the individual business. But in terms of there being somebody enforcing this requirement, again, as our previous caller had mentioned, these are oftentimes changes that come about because a person with a disability makes a complaint to the business owner, asks for the help to make that entrance accessible. And then if the business owner is responsive, they can often do that work pretty quickly. It is, I think, when the business owner doesn't understand the complaint or perhaps is resistant to it, that it goes to the level of becoming a lawsuit. And with lawsuits, one can never say exactly how long it will take to resolve.
Yeah. Well, there are, as we heard from Kim earlier, there are these lawsuits that are basically predator lawsuits in a way. There are unscrupulous, I would say unscrupulous, you might not use that word, but attorneys who look for small businesses to sue because they see that they're out of compliance. So would you support any kind of reform so that there be, for example, a period of time where small business owners can comply before they're, you know, liable for some kind of a judgment?
It's a good observation. There actually have been some reforms of the California state law over the last few years that do give the small business owners exactly that, a little bit of breathing room. But that, again, is tied to that CASP program, the Certified Accessibility Specialist inspection, because if a business owner is proactive and they've already done that investigation and hired the inspector and they're working on a plan, then that plan actually gives them a cooling off period before the matter can even go to court. So I would always recommend that every business owner survey their facilities using a CASP inspector.
And Kim Stone, are there any efforts in the legislature to make any additional changes?
Yeah, my organization has been supporting what you just suggested, which we call notice and opportunity to cure, which is basically ask the restaurant or tell the business what the problem is, ask them to fix it before you sue them. That solution would do two things. One, it would reduce the excessive and predatory lawsuits, and two, it would actually lead to increased compliance. We've been supporting that for over a decade, but sadly, the trial lawyers and some members of the disability rights community have stopped those reforms, you know, every year for the past decade. There is one bill that is still alive this year, Senate Bill 251 by Senator Richard Ross, that would create a notice and opportunity to cure for certain specified technical violations, like having the wrong signage or not having truncated domes, which we support, and that's a step in the right direction. But we think that if we did do something like notice and opportunity to cure for all ADA violations, then you would get rid of the predatory lawsuits and you would actually lead to increased access, because Milton from Oakland could go to the restaurant and say, look, will you just fix this? And then, you know, and ask them to. And if they didn't, well, then go ahead and sue them rather than having to go find a lawyer and go through that cumbersome process at the get-go.
Yeah. All right. Let's go back to the phones now. And Barney in Berkeley, welcome. You're on forum.
Hi, good morning, and thank you for bringing light to this important topic. I was wondering if you could address, I think it's great that you're talking about all the technical aspects of the ADA, but I think there's a bigger picture that gets overlooked, and that is, what's the experience of the person with a disability? So you might have a property or business that is technically accessible, but the experience of the person with a disability is not equal to that of others. And my example is that I recently went to a brand new restaurant in San Francisco. Every single table in there was high. That seems to be a design trend right now that really makes it impossible for
kind
people.
Kind of like almost bar seating, almost.
I'm sorry?
Almost like bar seating.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's a design trend. So perhaps, and what I was told at the restaurant was, well, we meet the maximum height. And so they were prepared with that answer. So they knew that their tables were high because they had a response to it. And so what they didn't see or overlooked was, well, maybe they do meet the code, but there's no way someone in a wheelchair could sit at that table and enjoy a meal with their family and friends.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if you can just address that issue of we need to take a broader look and think about the total experience. And then it starts again with a website. There's no website I can go to find out if a restaurant is an accessible restaurant.
Yeah.
And that restaurant would maybe say that they were accessible on their website.
Sure. Yeah, Carla, what about that? To what extent do these inspectors look for, are they just measuring things, so to speak, versus thinking about the experience?
Well, there's a lot of, layers of nuance in that particular experience. And I would agree with the caller that how people are treated, the experience that they have when they visit these public accommodations, that is really a big part of this package, too. And it's not just the seating. It's also how the host or the hostess or the wait person accommodates the individual with a disability during their visit there. But to go back to the architectural pieces of it, it sounds to me like that restaurant actually had a fundamental misunderstanding of their obligations under both the ADA as well as the California Building Code, because there are requirements that a proportion of the seating be at an accessible height so that a person who uses a wheelchair or other mobility device is able to comfortably have their meal and park themselves, clear of any aisles and traffic. So I think that one restaurant owner was a little unclear on the concept of how to accommodate people with disabilities.
Yeah, but again, the burden is on the small business person. It seems that the city, as part of its inspection process for a brand new business, that the inspectors, if they knew what the ADA compliance levels were, that they could have been caught before it opened or even before it got to the point of being built.
Sure. I think that the inspectors, in all fairness, they have a pretty large mandate. They are looking at everything from life safety, fire safety, energy conservation, plus accessibility. And it really has to be an entire team approach to this accessible architectural environment. What we need are good architects who can design the project from the get-go. We need good plan checkers who can confirm that the project will comply. We need good inspectors who can verify that through their inspection process. But we do this all together with our disability advocates who raise the issue to our attention in the first place.
All right. And I want to introduce Kim Stone. Go ahead.
I have heard of a couple local jurisdictions who on their own hire certified access specialists who work for the city or who work for the county. And then when someone submits their plans, in addition to the building code people looking over those plans for all the things they need to, the access specialists will look over it and then they'll go back to the developer and tell them, look, these are the ways that you're not compliant right now, and allow them that advance notice to fix the problem at the design stage so that they don't have to do it after it's already built and open, which saves costs for the business, person at the front end, and that at least ensures that new businesses going forward in those jurisdictions are, in fact, accessible. Now, that's the local government in and of their own accord through no requirement, adding a step to the process. But I really applaud that. I think that's a great idea because it does improve access and reduce those lawsuits.
Yeah. We're joined now by Arlene Mayerson, who's directing attorney for Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund. And you were caught in traffic. So ADA can't help with that, I'm afraid, but glad you finally made it.
Thank you.
Let me just ask you, as you join us here, I don't know if you've heard the conversation for the last 40 minutes or so, but what do you see as the frontiers of the ADA? Like, what are some of the issues that maybe weren't anticipated by the ADA that groups like yours are working on now?
Well, thank you, first of all, very much for having me on the program. My organization, Disability Rights Education Defense Fund, had the great privilege of being involved in the writing and passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act. And I just wanted to, give the overall perspective that this law is history-making, a sea change in the way disability is perceived in this country, a policy seismic changes. It is huge in terms of the lives of people with disabilities and the perception of people with disabilities. And I think that we really need to celebrate that this law is so historic and so fundamental for people with disabilities in the United States and has spurred an international movement of people with disabilities around the world who are looking to the ADA to pass similar laws in their own country. The UN now has a treaty on the rights of people with disabilities, which would have been unprecedented before the ADA, incorporates the ADA within it. You know, while I appreciate some of the concerns that have been expressed on the program, this is the small story. The big story is that this law has completely changed the landscape for millions of people and included them in the mainstream of American life.
Yeah, and both can be true. I mean, it can be a big story for a small person who has a business to be sued also. I mean, I'm not to I don't want to diminish what they've gone through, although obviously it is a landmark legislation that's affected and helped, you know, millions of people.
Yes, I mean, it's a civil rights law. And so, you know, I could go through some of the points that were made earlier about—
No, we don't want to do that.
But we don't want to do that.
Yeah, yeah. Let me ask, to what extent have countries adapted this approach? And what parts of the world would you say are picking up, are taking our lead and which aren't?
Well, I mean, what's interesting around the world is that, you know, we had a conference many years ago, actually, where we had 70 countries from around the world. And we're talking about countries that are very, at the beginning of starting constitutional governments like Ghana. We have in the South Africa, we have all around the world, not just European countries, but in all of the continents around the world. This is an international movement.
Yeah.
And you also asked about the future. What's very interesting right now is applying the Americans with Disabilities Act to the technological revolution that's happened since its passage. So in 1990, when we were doing the Americans with Disabilities Act and listed the kinds of public accommodations that would be included in the law, we were looking around our neighborhoods because that's where commerce took place. And now commerce has moved to such a great extent to the internet that the big push of our organization, Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund, has been to make sure that this internet marketplace is also available for people with disabilities.
And Carla addressed that a little bit earlier in terms of folks being able to read what's on a website. But what are some of the other ways in which you're thinking about that?
Well, the lawsuit that our organization brought that I'm very proud of is when Netflix hit the scene, it was this revolution in entertainment. Watch what you want, where you want, whenever you want. And so everyone was very excited about that. And then it turned out that all this wonderful programming that they had 23 million subscribers. That was many years ago. But it wasn't available to deaf and hard of hearing individuals who wanted to access it. And so what we did is we sued Netflix and to say, this is wonderful what you have, but you have to make it accessible to deaf and hard of hearing individuals as well. And we're able to enter a negotiation settlement with Netflix where they have 100% of their content captioned. Well, that led very much to an industry standard. And since then, we had a very conciliatory agreement with Apple, iTunes, for captioning. We've had Vudu, which is owned by Walmart, for captioning. And now we're just moving ahead. And most recently, we filed a lawsuit against MIT and also Harvard universities for their online educational program. So it's not just education anymore. I mean, it's not just entertainment that's taking place online, but it's education. It's healthcare. It's very, very important that this remain accessible to all of us.
All right, let's read some email here from listeners. We have one that says, as an older person, I will probably need facilities that are ADA compliant, but I've seen small businesses go out of business because someone came to inspect, found some measurements off, dinged them with a lawsuit. They were unable to afford remodeling. And so San Francisco, a city that supposedly values its small businesses, is now one small business less. Why can't we grandfather in small businesses? Carla?
Well, I'd like to actually talk about some of the supports that the City of San Francisco has provided for small businesses, because through our Office of Economic and Workforce Development, the city has actually paid for CASP inspections so that small businesses would get the information that they need so that they could take those constructive steps towards removing the barriers. Our office also works very closely with the Office of Small Business to do quite a bit of outreach so that people, again, have a much better understanding of the basic things that they need to do to avoid those lawsuits and have their services accessible to the public.
Here's another email from Pedro, and this gets into a whole other realm of the ADA. He writes, I'm a combat veteran with PTSD. What type of rights do I have at work that might be related to the ADA?
Well, I think that that's a very important question, and the veterans have always been very, very important in disability access, disability rights. The laws wouldn't have been passed without them because they're so important to the American public. There are rights for this person for PTSD. I don't know what the particular situation is, but accommodations are required in employment, and person with PTSD would be included in the definition of disability.
And how do folks with mental health disabilities, how are they covered by ADA?
The ADA covers people with physical and mental disabilities. And the California law does now also. Originally, California law, which was actually a predecessor to the ADA, did not cover mental disabilities. But now both California and federal law cover people with mental disabilities.
Yeah, give an example or two of how a business would have to comply with that aspect of it or any accommodation.
Well, I suppose that if someone it's hard for me to just pick something out of the air, but I suppose if someone had particular accommodations at work that related particularly to PTSD, they would ask their employer for those accommodations, and they would have a dialogue, which is also built into the law.
Yeah. All right, let's go back to the phones now. And Bob in Sonoma, welcome.
Yeah, hi, thank you. As a design professional, I have the opportunity to work on some Indian casinos in California. And I'm curious, and I've been doing some research, and I haven't been that successful as to if an Indian tribe is designated as a sovereign nation and they're exempt from the California Building Code, would that make it also true with respect to the ADA?
We've got people throwing their hands up in the air here. Bob, good question, though, huh? Yeah. Arlene, what do you think?
Well, boy, I don't think there's anyone who's ever stumped me on a disability question in the last 35 years.
Congratulations,
but I'm afraid
Bob.
I'll have to get back to you on that one.
Wow, great question, though. What's your experience been, Bob? Just do the tribe say they just don't have to comply and— And therefore, they don't even want to consider it in their design of the casinos?
Well, that's not true, because design professionals, as far as the regulations for their licensing, you know, standard of care issues come up. And, you know, design professionals really should be looking at this as if it were in compliance. That's my opinion. I mean, that's what I do as a design professional.
Yeah. Carla?
Well, and also they have customers, right? Like, the point that we haven't really brought up yet is that a lot of businesses, you know, need to become compliant so they don't get sued, but they also, like the woman's experience at the restaurant in San Francisco, they should become compliant because these are customers. I mean, the disability community is a minority group that any of us can join at any time, unlike other minority groups that some people are born into. While some people are born with disabilities, some people acquire them over the course of their lifetimes. And many businesses that are a little bit more savvy and sophisticated about this know that by becoming compliant, that's sort of a marketing tool.
Sure. Yeah. Carla Johnson?
Sure. I'd just like to weigh in on that, too. Whether or not you're required to comply with the ADA or not, it's always a best practice and a safe harbor to do so. And when you look at the relative costs for making a casino accessible, when it's new construction, there is almost zero additional cost to make that facility 100% accessible. The challenge really is when we are trying to retrofit our existing older buildings. So as the design professional working with your client, my advice would be go for the ADA, go for it full, and that way the entire community will be able to access that service.
And Bob, I'm sort of intrigued by your question here. So are you saying that there are casinos that do in fact have ADA problems that you're aware of?
Without getting into too much detail, yes, I can say that is true. And it's also interesting that these are assembly occupancy buildings. You know, you have a lot of guests. you have a lot of elderly guests requiring special access requirements. You know, anybody can visit any one of these hotels and casinos and see that.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, thanks very much for the question. It's, I'm sure it's maybe a whole new area of litigation, Arlene.
Yeah. I wanted to add, actually, also that we've spent a lot of time on physical access, and that's a very important part of the law. But this law goes way beyond physical access and has benefited people with a variety of disabilities. And in the area of mental disability that we were about to discuss, the statistics on institutionalization are very impressive since the ADA. The Supreme Court came out with a decision called Olmstead, which basically says that segregating individuals with mental disabilities or other disabilities in institutions is a form of discrimination. And since then, the institutionalization rates have decreased by at least half.
Hmm. Some more email here. Marilyn writes, I live at a 990-unit condo complex. We have no parking or other ADA accommodations. Does a condo association need to comply? Arlene?
Well, I would say yes. This is a tricky area because there's also a Fair Housing Act. And so the housing is actually covered by the Fair Housing Act, but the association might very well be covered by the ADA, and there should be parking. And all of these questions also can be referred to me at any point after the show at Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund.
All right. Here's another email from William, who writes, the ADA also requires all fire stations to be fully ADA compliant. I believe San Jose had to do this, and they've claimed that response time has increased due to this because the facility is that much larger. Have you heard anything about that?
I don't know. That sounds very I'm skeptical.
Yeah. Tom writes, the largest area for abuse is not ADA. It is California Title 24 and the UNRU Act. These are the ones that create large financial incentives for unethical lawsuits. Other states do not have the same level of abuse as California. Arlene, we had a long discussion about that. Anything you'd like to add?
Well, yeah, that is the one thing I'd like to add, that one of your guests said that the problem is that the federal law is paired with the UNRU Act, which has money damages attached to it. And that was a very important part in the drafting of the Americans with Disabilities Act to make sure that we weren't also taking away anything that already existed in state law. So all that's doing really and is making people with disabilities on the same level as other people covered by the UNRU Act, racial minorities, ethnic minorities, et cetera. So this isn't a special thing for people with disabilities. This is a thing for breaking civil rights laws.
All right, let's go back to the phones. And Kevin in San Francisco, welcome.
Thank you. My question is directed to in connection with a large condominium redevelopment project that's going up in San Francisco called the Shipyard out at Hunter's Point. I went out and looked at those condominiums. They're all multi-unit buildings, usually 6 or 7 stories tall. None of them have elevators. I'm 60 years old, and I went, I'm sorry, I can't buy here. I'm 60 years old. I can't schlep my groceries up 7 flights of stairs. Hmm. And I asked the salesperson, how are you ADA compliant with this kind of construction?
Hmm.
And she responded, well, the ADA compliance is on the first floor.
Hmm.
Is that how it's supposed to work?
Yeah. Carla?
That is correct, actually. Under the Fair Housing Act, which later got incorporated into the California Building Code, there's 2 different levels of access to buildings depending upon the type of features that they provide. If you have a building that has an elevator, then all of the units in that building have to be adaptable and some actually accessible. However, if you don't have an elevator in that building, then the only units that are subject to the accessibility codes are the ground floor units.
And Kevin, this, you're saying this is still being built or it's now available for sale or what?
It's going to be built over 20 years. There's many units for sale already.
Okay, so these are the Lennar developments?
Six stories, you know, seems to be like a pretty tall building to be built without elevators.
Yeah.
Because there are other reasons why building codes require elevators. And, of course, one of the first is to make sure that fire personnel can quickly serve that building. So usually you only see buildings that are about 2 or 3 stories built without elevators.
That would seem to be a real marketing problem to rent or sell something on the 7th floor with no elevator.
Another thing to look into after the show.
Yes. All right. Thanks very much.
I would also suggest, Carla? Too, that any time that you see a building that's under construction that you don't feel is really meeting the accessibility laws as you understand it, I would encourage you to call that into the Department of Building Inspection and allow them to investigate that for you.
All right. Here's another email from Joe in Oakland who writes, I love the ADA. I had a stroke 2 years ago at the age of 26 and a wheelchair bound, among other things. The ADA has allowed me to experience restaurants, hotels, and other establishments without having to worry about accessibility. I enjoy the fact that the rules are federally standardized. Enjoy traveling. I've gone from Kansas to Georgia to Hawaii, assured of accessibility. And I'm sure you hear that kind of thing all the time, Arlene.
Absolutely. And again, not just for people who use wheelchairs, but for all kinds of people with all kinds of disabilities.
Yeah.
Families can stay together when they go on vacation, when they go out to eat, when they go to recreational activities.
We're getting to the end of the hour, but I wonder if you could speak to – we talked about the next frontier, Arlene, but where do you see it with, for example, companies like Lyft and Uber, which don't have to comply, unlike, say, taxi companies? Just real quickly, where is that going?
Where that's going is in litigation, and the disability community feels very strongly that if you're going to be using the city facilities such as the streets and et cetera, that you can't just block out people with disabilities.
All right. Arlene Meyerson, thanks so much for coming in, a directing attorney from Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund. Thanks also to Carla Johnson and Kim Stone on the phone. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg, and Suki Lewis. Our online producer is Amanda Stupai. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our engineer today is Danny Bringer. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. Thanks so much for listening.